This episode of Behind the Bots is brought to you by Fingertech Robotics, North America's top manufacturer of combat robotics parts. If you're interested in building your first combat robot, check out Fingertech's Viper Kit, which includes everything you need to build a fully functional, competitive Antweight. Fingertech also carries a complete line of wheels, hubs, motors, and other components if you want to build a bot from the ground up. Check them out online at www.fingertechrobotics.com.
From our living rooms, as we practice social distancing, this is Behind the Bots, the podcast that brings you the stories of the builders behind BattleBots. I'm Chris.
I'm Luke.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Kyle.
And today on the podcast, our interview with BattleBots judge Lisa Winter.
We'll wrap up the show today with a new segment that we're calling Robots from Around the World. We're temporarily pausing the Combat Robotics event calendar while the world is practicing social distancing because we care about you and your health, so take a hint, stay at home. If you like our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, CastBox, Player FM, and Podbean. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Behind the Bots. Or you can check out our website at www.behindthebots.com. And since we know that you don't have anything better going on, tell a friend about our podcast. We really appreciate your support.
Time for this week's Combat Robotics News. I have 8 news items for you today. First, some good news from the world of online fundraisers. Shark Opry and Captain Ed Robinson has raised enough money to buy an RV.
Woo-hoo!
As you recall... That's right. Woohoo. As you recall, Ed put out a call to the community for help raising $3,000 to buy an RV to live in after the house he had been living in was sold. We offered up some exclusive Behind the Bots merchandise, and the community rallied behind the fundraiser, giving Ed more than $2,100 so far. Ed says he's purchased an RV and plans to temporarily move to Slab City, a semi-autonomous artist collective in the California desert out near the Salton Sea. So that's great news.
That's awesome news. Good for Ed, man. I'm so happy for him that he's got a place to keep his robot and keep himself.
And that's the type of place where Ed would thrive.
Yeah, he'll be mayor in no time. Now, Luke, you said you've been here before, right?
I have been out to Slab City. And I would encourage anybody in Southern California to go and check it out. It is like one of the coolest day trips that you can make from San Diego. I should try and tell this quickly because I could talk about Slab City literally all day. It's a couple miles away from the Salton Sea. So Salton Sea was this man-made lake, and they thought it was going to be like the Lake Tahoe of the South. It turned out to be this huge environmental disaster. And all of the fish inside of the lake, they die every single year. So when you go to this lake out in the middle of the desert, every year they have like millions of tilapia that are born, and then they all like suck all of the oxygen out of the lake and they die. So when you're like looking at it from afar, you're like, oh my God, it's like a white sand beach. But when you actually go down to the beach, you realize that it's just fish bones, like just millions, billions of just dead fish. It's incredible. And there's really, really like lots of cool kind of things to see around the lake. So like Bombay Beach, which is this resort community that collapsed, and now people drive around in kind of dusty golf carts, and every other house is abandoned. It's like really cool. They have Salvation Mountain out there, where it was this guy who crash landed a hot air balloon and had this vision for this monument to Christianity. So he just started painting this mountain, and it's just like it's really, really cool. I would encourage anyone to go out and see it. Did any of us here? I mean, I've never asked this, but did you play Grand Theft Auto, like the latest Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah. So, you know, like, the character Trevor, like, the kind of wild and crazy one? He lives out around the Salton Sea. So that's kind of, like, the feel, like, this kind of slightly lawless desert environment. It's really, really cool.
So for our friends, then, that live in, like, the Los Angeles area, all they need to do is hop onto a burning ice cream truck and drive straight north about for 4.5 minutes, and then they'll get there?
Yes, that's...
Yeah,
that's
crashing exactly into everyone, paying no attention to traffic laws, and destroying any stop sign you see on the way.
Oh, so you've been to L.A.
But the great news is that Ed is has an RV, and I'm really glad that we were able to play a small part in that and participate in that fundraiser. Speaking of fundraisers and contests, the Merry Pranksters at Robot Wars Shunt Posting are organizing a contest, inviting people to make replicas of their favorite combat robots using materials exclusively found inside their houses. The contest, called Scrapple Bots, will have three categories, one for adults, one for kids, and one for the funniest entry, which they're calling the Shunty McShunt Post. To enter, donate to the Trussell Trust and send a photo of your Scrapbot with proof of donation to one of the admins of Robot Wars Shunt Posting before 5 p.m. Eastern on Thursday, April 2nd. Super cool, like, contest, right?
I love this idea. First of all, there's obviously going to be a lot of crossover, but if you're listening to the show and you're not a member of Robot Wars Shunt Posting and you're totally okay with not family-friendly robot content, go join that group. They do amazing work, and they post really funny stuff all the time. This is such a great idea. What a cool thing for kids to be doing at home, for people to be doing at home. I cannot wait to see what everybody comes up with, and it's donating to a really great cause.
Yeah.
The Trussell Trust.
The Trussell Trust is a nonprofit based in the UK, and they're raising money during this time to help families who are impacted from quarantines and layoffs due to coronavirus. Meanwhile, we're getting new details about the 2020 version of Chomp, which is returning to the competition this year as a super heavyweight walker bot. The team posted CAD renderings of part of the bot, writing on Facebook, quote, "Borrowing from military tank terminology, we are referring to the lower body as the quote-unquote hull. Here are the final designs of the hull in Autodesk Inventor, showing the frame, leg layout, high-pressure gas vessel, ridiculous turret bearing, and the armor, quote-unquote, hoop skirt. The renderings show the bot will have six legs and a fairly wide base, with what appears to be a turret capable of 360-degree motion, where, conceivably, they'll mount a giant hammer." What do you think about this? Incredible, right?
Oh my gosh, this thing is so pretty to look at. It's just gorgeous. I cannot wait to see the entire robot. The design is super smart. I love the fact that the air tank is like dead center of everything, so it can literally never get ruptured. And I think that those cool shock mounts for the hoop skirt are so smart. Like, it's good. This team's just the best.
I really hope that we can see, like, the legs moving. Like, I imagine in my head, like, a very creepy kind of, like, six-legged insect kind of moving with this giant hammer. It's as like every single time that they put out a rendering, I get more hyped for this bot.
So they said in one of their – because they post these things, and then they're super responsive to people's questions, not just, like – the account of Chomp, but the members of the team themselves have been jumping in, answering people's questions, which has been really cool. It's been awesome to, like, kind of in real time talk to them about their design process. And one of the things that Josh has said when he was talking about it was the hoop skirt is specifically designed so you can see almost the entirety of the leg movement. And in fact, they gave up on some protective potential of the hoop skirt just so you could see that leg motion because, hey, this is a show about entertainment. We want to see that those legs moving. We want to see how they operate. That's part of what makes this so cool. So, yeah, you're definitely going to see them moving in there. I think from camera angles especially, they're going to be fully articulated.
That's amazing. Speaking of scary weapons, South Korea-based Team Orbi this week posted photos of their newest blade, which is made of aluminum. The team says they've got other cheaper blades coming in the mail, including one they're calling the Deadly Carrot. All right. What do you think the Deadly Carrot looks like? I have to know.
I have no idea what the... I mean, it's got to be an off, like, asymmetrical blade. That's the only thing.
Is it a carrot-shaped blade?
Yeah, I hope that it's, like, a sharp point on one side and then, like, a short, bushy top on the other side of just metal spikes and dangerousness. And I have no idea. This team's so cool. I'm so glad that they got invited. I'm so glad that they accepted. I really hope that everything works out. That they can be there for the competition this year, and that everybody that's been invited can be there, plus all the Chinese teams. That's the hope, right? But yeah, this is such a pretty bot, and I'm really excited. The aluminum blade looks just gorgeous. Really good machining work. I can't wait to see them.
Yeah.
Oh, shout out to Team Orby, because they made a very generous donation on Ed's GoFundMe, so I want to give them some credit there.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's really cool. The team behind Ripper, the much-feared British flipper, says they've overhauled their bot as they prepare to make their debut on the 2020 season of BattleBots. Updates include brushless four-wheel drive, thicker armor, and two carbon fiber nitrogen bottles for higher-pressured flips.
Sounds like you really don't want to be behind this Ripper.
What?
There's a joke in there, okay, guys? There's a good fart joke.
That's a pretty good fart joke.
In geeky swag news, the team behind the new dragon-themed heavyweight Ferocity is making keychains available for anyone to print for free. If you have access to a 3D printer, check out the team's design on Thingiverse. Meanwhile, if you're like me and need more of BattleBots announcer Farooq Tahid in your life, he's hosting a new TV show that will premiere on NBC on Saturday, April 4th. In each episode of Roots Less Traveled, Farooq will take two members of the same family on a journey into their past to learn more about their family tree. The show will be part of a new three-hour block of Saturday morning programming from NBC called The More You Know.
That's so cool. I didn't know that he was a part of another project like that. Our team's like, always use some more Farooq.
Yeah, he's hosting. So like it's more than just part of a project. He's gonna have major airtime, which is really, really cool. You know, like Farooq is super hardworking actor, voiceover artist, obviously much beloved BattleBots announcer. And it's neat that he's going to get a lot of screen time with this new show of his.
Did you guys ever see his show that he hosted? It was a game show about kids not making too much noise.
What?
What?
Oh, it's amazing. So he has this show that my kids and I found episodes of it on YouTube. I don't know which network it aired on. I just know it's a show specifically for kids, and they have to go through a series of challenges where they don't cap out on a certain number on the decibel meter, right? So, like, the kids have to reach into a bag of chips, pull out four chips, put them on a plate, then take the plate, move it over onto the stove, and once they get it onto the stove, they have to slide it over onto the counter, and they have to do all of this as silently as possible, but it's also timed, so they're, like, trying to meet these time frames without making any noise, and it is so stressful and so fun. And Farooq has the best facial reactions whenever the kids break the decibel meter and make it go into the red. It's hilarious.
I have to check this out. That sounds awesome.
My kids love it. We now, like, that's one of the things we'll go to on YouTube to find to watch. It's a lot of fun.
Is it successful, like, when you say, like, oh, let's play the quiet game, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, my son's excellent at the quiet game. My daughter is terrible at the quiet game. She knows she's bad at the quiet game, but, like, they're very competitive at it. They work very hard at it. Yeah, you can totally do that, at least up until 5. I don't know past that. We'll have to ask Sarah when we talk to her later.
I used to be a camp counselor, and we would make them play the quiet game every single day, and it was the best hour of the day.
And finally, from the world of animatronics, which Dr. Captain Andrea Galately this week published a delightful video showing off an important upgrade to the little plastic bird skeleton that sits atop Mike Galately's hat. The bird now moves, and its eyes glow. The team enlisted the help of BattleBots fan Ben Ryherd, who took apart the skeleton, added servos and motors, and programmed the bird. Ben is best known for creating 3D printed scale model replicas of famous BattleBots. Did you get to check out this video? It's like the best. It's so delightful.
It is really cool. Hey, Chris, that's some teams listening to your advice from the last episode, man. They're upping their production value for the show.
Step it up. You have the time. Step it up.
I can't wait for Mike Galately's interviews, you know, where they're zooming in on the hat and the bird is like doing a little dance. Like, it's gonna be the best. It's
like when he's like hunched over driving with that dead serious look on his face, and there's just this wild bird flapping on his head.
I know, and those post-fight interviews where he just looks drained, the poor man just looks so tired, and he's like, I don't remember what happened to that fight, but there's going to be this animated, happy skeleton bird on his head.
They should, like, also, like, hook up a wireless speaker to it so they can have, like, someone in the pits, like, do, like, a Bluetooth, like, talking version of the bird on his head.
Chris is never satisfied, all right? You know, they made an animated bird skeleton, and Chris is already saying why it needs to have blue teeth.
Yeah, but does it have laser eyes, Luke? That's the question.
And that's it for this week's news.
After the break, our interview with BattleBots builder and judge Lisa Winter.
This week on the podcast, we have a very special guest, BattleBots judge Lisa Winter. As a kid in the mid-90s, Lisa competed on BattleBots and Robot Wars from 1996 to 2002 with her bots Doughboy, Mr. Squeaky, and Tentomushi, and was crowned the Robot Wars Middleweight World Champion in 2000. She returned to the BattleBots reboot in 2015 with Plan X, and the following year with the much-beloved Mega Tento. More recently, she served as one of the show's three judges. Outside of combat robotics, Lisa works as a mechanical engineer at a construction equipment startup in Silicon Valley and has a personal interest in internet-connected devices that can help animals. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hey, guys. I'm here quarantined in Oakland.
Yeah, we're all quarantined, too. This is our first time ever recording in four different places. So if the audio comes across as strange, that's why. We're at two houses in the Hudson Valley in New York and one house in South Jersey and in Oakland too. So I guess the internet's pretty amazing, you know?
Yeah, and those places are like super affected. So it's good we're inside.
Yeah, that's true. I'd love to start by learning more about your early interest in combat robotics. You know, can you take us back to your earliest memories? Like, how did you learn about combat robotics, and how did you decide that this was something that you were interested in doing?
Yeah, I can tell you, there's a lot of good memories, and they go way back. Even before I started building, my favorite tool was like using a ratchet in the garage. It was sort of sad, but I loved it. But my first memory was my dad actually flying out, because we lived in the Midwest, and he went out to California to Fort Mason for the first Robot Wars. And, you know, I didn't know anything about it. No one really did. And he came back with a trophy. He won first place. And so after that, he also he brought back some VHS tapes of the competition, and I saw them, and because I think he was reviewing to show us, but also to look at the opponents and how he could do better in the next season. And I was like, this is a lot of fun. Like, what are my parents doing, saying that I am not allowed to go out here or something like that? So I was like, can I do this? And I was about, I was eight or so, I think, when I first saw these videos. And it was like 10 people maybe fighting or competing with their robots, and there was 2x4s around the base, around like what the arena would be, I guess, but that's as high as it went. It was like 2x4s, so you could just walk right over. It wasn't too safe at that time. And there was like SRL doing robot artistic events during lunch and stuff like that. So I was like, this is awesome. I want to do this. And my dad said, well, you know, drop some ideas. And if they look decent, maybe I'll help you build them. So that's really how it began. And my first robot was Doughboy. And I built that and competed when I was 10 years old. And it was just extremely fun.
How did your dad find out about Robot Wars and make the decision to go out? I mean, like that, it seems like it was such a small community at the time. Like how did the news reach out and kind of get him to come out to San Francisco?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, so it was nothing, right? There was no community, there was nothing except for one little ad in, I think it was Wired magazine, and yeah. That was from Mark Thorpe, and he just, like, mocked up some, because he's a model maker, so he did models that were in Star Wars, he made parts of the Death Star, and so he mocked up some radio, like, RC cars with chainsaws on them. Took a picture, and this ad was like, hey, just come out and we'll fight robots. And so my dad and a few other teams did this, you know, not knowing that anything was actually going to happen. But it turned out that people showed up.
Yeah. Tell us more about Doughboy. I mean, like, so today when, if there was, say, a 9 or 10 year old who wanted to build a combat robot, there's a huge community. There's kits that you can buy. I mean, there's build diaries and everything. But back in the mid 90s, building that first robot of yours, like there were just like none of that, you know, like, can you talk about like some of the challenges that existed then that don't necessarily exist today?
Oh my God. Yeah. No internet. Oh, no robot stores and no YouTube. So imagine a day when you're quarantined inside because it's Wisconsin and it's snowing outside, but you don't have the internet. So, you know, we had a lot of time and basically I watched the VHS tapes that my dad brought back. And, cause I think there's 2 seasons before I got involved. And so I was just looking, basically, seeing how the robots were, what their weapons were, what their defense was, what they looked like. And then from that, I was like, well, this, you know, this seems effective. This doesn't seem effective. And that's how I planned out Doughboy. I was just, you know, looking at these videos and thinking, okay, spinny things look really effective. They win a lot. And from there, you know, I penciled out a concept and then went to the local farm and fleet. So shout out to them. You know, it's just a hardware store for like farm equipment and bought basically everything that we needed. So it was a lawnmower blade on top and some pulleys, belts, like car belts, V-belts, some wheels that were, I think, also from a lawnmower, just like anything from the hardware store. And we also, like my dad and I would just walk up and down the aisles and see if anything just looked like it would be a good robot part, you know, because you can't walk into a store and be like, well, you know, I'm building a combat robot and I need I need a weapon. And like, it's just people really don't get that, you know? So, yeah, it was just a lot of trial and error, but it was a whole lot of fun and lots of hands-on and experience. And yeah, I mean, I think it was just a lot of fun, and half of that was because it was unknown.
Yeah. Do you remember your first combat robot fight? Does that stick out in your memory? Is that one of those kind of formative moments in your career as a competitor?
Yeah, I feel like it was almost more formative to me as a person and my personality. Just because I was a very, very shy kid, and it was really hard, and I would always turn bright red if I was talking in front of anyone, like in class, you know, and I was afraid to raise my hand and give answers. So the fact that there was an audience and we would bring the robot out and then they would announce my name and I would hold up my hand and be like, yep, that's me. I'm controlling this robot. And the fact that the audience also decided who was the winner. And so they would applaud at the end and, you know, by like a dB meter, or maybe it was just a human at that point. They would just decide what robot won. And so I also learned about aesthetics and like, let's make the robot look cool and let's get the audience really involved. And so all of that really like brought me out and helped me get more, you know, less embarrassed in front of people. So,
yeah. Back to some of your earliest designs. We have our first listener question from Will, who asks, what's the origin story behind the Tentamushi robots?
Tentamushi. So really it was like, again, back a long time ago, no internet. And, I was ready to change up the robot. So I really did like Doughboy a lot. And you know, he went pretty far, if I'm going to give Doughboy a gender. but yeah, he went real far. But I didn't feel like, you know, there was going to be any more progress. Like, I wanted change. And so, again, it was back to the drawing board of looking at what robots were working and what doesn't work. And then just going up and down, like, hardware stores and... I think it was my dad who actually was like, well, why don't we go to Toys R Us? And, again, oh my God, that's like dating me because I don't think those are around anymore either now. but you know, we looked down the aisles and I was like, oh, that Ladybug sandbox looks pretty cool. And my dad was like, well, okay, let's, you know, what would we do with it? But we buying it, and it just sort of came out of, you know, just looking at things and was like, this is a nice character, this would be really entertaining, and oh, I guess this is really big, so it could capture an opponent, and we just decided to try that out.
We have one last listener question about some of the early days of the sport. So this is from a listener named Nick, who asks, as you were deeply involved in the Comedy Central days of the show, which bot do you miss the most from that era?
I mean, I don't want to do like the cop-out answer, but honest, like everyone in those days, like they're all really awesome people and good friends. So I do miss everyone, but a lot of the people are back with the new BattleBots. And so I do get to see them. And that's like one of the main reasons why I just love coming back, no matter, you know, in what capacity, just to like see these people and be able to hang out with them at least once a year for 2 weeks while we destroy it, you know? So a lot of them are sort of the bots that you've seen now, but smaller versions. So like just, yeah, everyone who's competing now, you have Christian, Carlberg. Well, I guess Biohazard isn't around anymore, but I don't know. I'm going to have to go look back at all the people. I think a lot of them are the same.
So Lisa, this is Kyle. I have a few questions about your design philosophy. But before we go away from Comedy Central days of BattleBots, I do have a personal question that I've been wanting to ask you. what's Jay Leno like, and is he as does he smell as good as people say?
Wait, that's a thing. I never smelled him, but he's a really nice guy, and so if that should be a rumor too, is that he's just a very nice and very smart guy, and he loves cars and building stuff. So he actually he came back when my dad and I were like prepping the robot to go onto the show, and he's like, hey, you know, do you guys need anything? Like, I've got some tools. And he helped us move the robot. And what? So yeah, like he's pretty awesome.
That's awesome. That's really, really cool. Wow, that's so neat. And I love that he was so involved in the Comedy Central Days of the Sport and had you guys on his show a lot. That was a cool kind of crossover cultural thing.
Definitely. Yeah. I don't think it was just some sort of marketing thing. Like he was definitely into it.
So let's get into your design philosophy. Nelly the Elliebot teammate Rira Granger asks, what's your main design philosophy? When you get an idea for a bot, do you take it down a similar route each time, or innovate and design more freeform? Also, what is your favorite type of wheel?
All right, good questions. I think design for me in the beginning, well, for the whole design for the robot needs to have function and form. So I'm not going to design just like a straight like metal box with no character. Because to me, this is entertainment, and it's fun. It's fun for me. It's fun for like the builders, but it's also fun for the people watching the show. So I have to do something, but it has to look cool doing it, right? So that's my philosophy there. And I think maybe what part of your question was asking too was like, well, does it change throughout the process? And I mean, I would say, yes, I'm not one of those builders who will CAD up like a document and create one. Sorry, I don't know exactly how technical I should get here, but like basically like 3D modeling and stuff like that. I'm not going to 3D model the entire robot and send it out and have it machined and all that and have it come back and just like, this is the robot and I'm never going to change it. I'm sort of more old school because building is a lot of the fun for me. So I'll draw something up on paper. I have been moving a bit more towards CAD, especially to something if it's really precise and I need to machine like a motor bracket or something. But, you know, along the way, if let's say for Mega Tento, when we were designing a lifting mechanism, you know, it changed like 3 times. So we would mock something up, you know, sometimes out of wood, see if it worked and change it. So I think the design process is pretty fluid in terms of at least like mechanics and stuff like that. Oh, and then so the wheel. I wonder what she's getting at here with that question.
I can give you some context if you're interested.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So Rira was a competitor. She was on a team for BuggleBots this season. And she made a comment in one of the episodes, because she was the weapon operator for that team, that she was going to eat all of the wheels in the competition. And then that kind of became a meme in the robot combat community that Rira Granger is the devourer of wheels. So she's asking you what your favorite wheel is, partially out of function of the wheel, but also for the flavor.
the wheel flavor. Well, I would say it's definitely nice to have wheels that do not go flat. So you want some type of foam in there. Colorful foam is preferred. Especially if you're devouring it. However, speaking from the judge's perspective, if there's a lot of foam or like debris of some sort flying out of your robot, it does not look good. You may get points taken away if it looks like your robot's falling apart.
Valid.
Yeah.
So let's move on a little bit to kind of the modern reboot of BattleBots and some really awesome robots that you put into that competition. So you competed on BattleBots in 2015 and 2016 with Plan X, which was an absolutely amazing old school space themed robot. And then Megatento. So Robert, a listener, asks, when Megatento was built, how did you project the bot's performance when seeing the full release of the season's roster? Did you expect the bot to reach the performance it obtained, or did you expect it to do better or worse? What were your thoughts?
I feel like Robert is thinks that I think about this a lot more than I do. we're given, there's such a short time period for design and build that you, there's not much of that analytics that can really go into it, I would say. But basically, I just thought, from 2015 to 16, I wanted something different. Plan X did not live up to my performance. And so I wanted to change it up. I was like, there's, you know, we're not going to improve on this. Let's change it up. And going back, I guess, to some of the design questions before, it was like, well, we do need character. And I think a lot of people are missing Tentomushi. And, you know, holy blank, like, this would look freaking crazy if it was 250 pounds, right? Like, Tentomushi was 60 pounds.
It looked awesome.
Yeah, I was like, Tentomushi originally is 60 pounds, so hello, Mega Tento is gonna be scary. And so, but also, like, I felt like in the 2015-ish time, it was still a bit serious, you know, the look of the robots and how people were feeling. And so I wanted to bring back that character and trying to get an audience of younger, especially like young females, more interested in the show at that time.
That makes perfect sense. I do want to give you, I know you said, you know, Plan X didn't live up to your expectation, but from a personal standpoint, Plan X was ahead of its time in a lot of ways. I mean, you had a blade of armor, you had modular weapons, like a lot of things that people are using now, like all the time on their robots, you were kind of prototyping on Plan X.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that. I think, like, to me, sometimes I can be a little OCD, and so I felt that given we only had basically, and when I say we, I mean like it was myself and my dad at this point joining together for the first time as a team, because before he had all of his own separate robots, and I had my separate robots, but for Plan X, we're like, okay, let's. BattleBots is back, let's do this. And so we joined up, and we only had 2 days to come up with a design. So from my standpoint, I was just like, I didn't feel comfortable really with the speed of that. But we did come up with a lot of unique things, like you said, and it was really about trial and error. And so having the blade of armor, and also that crazy weapon we were just testing physics and seeing what the hell would happen, because it was like, okay, we have two titanium rods and they're spinning hunks of steel as the blade, like physics would say it would work, but it was a little different in reality. So yeah, we just wanted to experiment.
I personally really liked Plan X. The color changing brain on it was one of my favorite features. I thought that was really cool. So let's talk about your transition from competitor to judge. You know, that happened into the 2018 season, right? We all skipped 2017. So we came back for 2018 and you were now on the judges panel. Listener Graham Grizz Glover III has a 2-part question. Number one, what made you move from being a competitor to being a judge? And two, are there any fights that you scored one way, but on rewatching it on TV, maybe thought otherwise?
Oh, yeah. Well, I, you know, being a judge is, it is an amazing opportunity. And so to start off with the first question, I was contacted from BattleBots. They thought it was a great idea to have builders be, you know, have like a set of three constant builders being the judges. And it just makes a whole lot of sense to me. You know, in terms of like understanding robotics, materials, what it's like to be fighting, the history of the robots and all of that. And a blade of armor, like just like, you know, is this weapon actually doing something? I think it makes a whole lot of sense for judges to be past competitors. And I don't know, I'm not entirely sure what I was thinking at that time, if it was a hard decision or not, but I was very honored. And I think with the way that my career was going, it was a lot more work. And so I didn't really have as much time in my personal life to be building. So I took this as like, yeah, Greg, this is a great opportunity to sort of like jump ahead. And instead of competing, like basically level up and be a judge felt like an honor. And I really enjoy doing that and being able to still see all the competitors and be there. So I definitely would not ever give that up if I had the choice. And then what was the second question again?
The second question are there any fights that you scored one way, but after rewatching it on TV, maybe thought otherwise?
Yeah. Oh, I feel like some people would like this answer to be different, but I totally stand by all of my judging decisions just from, you know, for this perspective that we had right outside of the arena, watching the fights. You know, I just fully support what we all said at the time. But I do understand, especially from watching all the episodes air, that things look so different from the TV cameras, and they have different perspectives and the angles are different. And it really does look different. So I'm not sure what to say there, but, you know, being there live, I totally stand by the points that I gave.
I like that. So there's a couple more listener questions that we have specifically about judging, but I have one for you. So the new point system for judging the 2020 system. We understand from Greg that you kind of had some input into that. What are your thoughts on the new scoring system that you guys will be working under? What are some things you're excited about with it? And what are some things that you're maybe a little bit cautious about with it?
Yeah, so the previous, or let's see, 2018, we had four categories, right? And then 2019, we changed it to just damage, aggression, and control. And we're going to keep those for this next 2020 season. But we're going to change up the points. And I think basically what we do is the judges and Greg and some of the refs, like we do join up in the off season and we talk about this and we have a lot, we review fights and basically see what's worked and what doesn't work. So I'm really happy that we're able to improve on this and change it every year if we need to. So I'm happy about that. And I'm really happy about the way we're changing the points for this next season, because instead of 3-2-2, it's going to be 5-3-3. And so we'll be able to have just like a lot, we'll be able to fine tune it more. And instead of, as an example, if it was 3-2-2 still.
Hold on, just to clarify. So that's damage, three control, three damage, two control, two aggression, two, five damage, three control, and three aggression. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So like last year, if one robot was slightly more aggressive, you would probably have to give 2 points to the more aggressive robot and 0 to the other robot. Otherwise, it would be 1-to-1.
Right.
But that's just really not usually the case. So you have one robot that's slightly more aggressive. Now we can give them 2 points and the other robot 1. So it's less of a huge jolt to the system. It's only 1 point difference when you add everything up. So I think, and basically we tested this. So during the entire airing of the 2019 season, I rejudged everything. And I actually, I think Greg and every single judge rejudged everything with the new 5-3-3 point system. And it really did work a lot better.
Were there any results that changed dramatically?
I would say slightly. And I don't honestly remember which fights, but there were slight changes.
I mean, everybody's going to ask, so I'm going to ask. Tombstone versus Gruff, how did that change? Did it change?
Well, I like honestly don't have those notes in front of me.
For the record, in our personal podcast debate about that particular fight, I 100% supported the judge's decision. So there's that.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like if it's more than like a month after the fights, like it's just too hard for me to talk about because I don't want to get anything wrong.
Fair enough. All right, so let's move on to some of our listener questions. So 4-time giant nut winner Paul Ventimiglia asks, is it better on the judging side or on the competitor side of BattleBots filming? Asking for a friend, ..
Oh. Well, better in terms of what? There's
you get better snacks? Like what? Like how is that?
Let's see. Well, I'll tell you one thing that's I don't know if it's better or possibly worse, is that our day starts. We have to be on set at least 5:10 a.m. and the filming goes from noon all the way until 10 p.m. So, and then there's the stuff we have to do post, right? So there's the pre and the post. So these are long days.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could take some breaks here and there as a builder. I mean, I remember as a builder it was pretty nonstop, but if you wanted to take a nap, you could do it. I've definitely gotta have my eyes wide open for every single match. But a pro would be I get to see every single match. So that's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, that is pretty darn cool. All right. So Robot Ruckus organizer and friend of the podcast, Lilith Specht, asks, in your personal opinion as a judge, disregarding BattleBots criteria, what is the most important aspect of determining a winner of a match? In other words, if it were completely up to you to pick a winner, how would you determine that?
I mean, it is very, I guess it would be very similar to the actual judging criteria, because it's all about, it's a fight. So it would just be how much you obliterate the opponent.
All right. So now let's start our own little Lisa Winter advice corner. And we have a question from superfan Mary Catherine Carr, who's looking for some advice. And she wants to know, as you've been doing this since you were a youngling and have now swapped to judging, I'm sure you've dealt with the broad spectrum of naysayers and haters. What's your best advice for girls coming into the robot combat sport? How would you advise them on weathering these comments? And what has been your go-to coping mechanism when these comments have gotten especially loud?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it is quite serious. it's a bit odd for me to give, for my advice when I was a kid, it would be a lot different just because the communication and social media, like the internet wasn't really a big thing. So I was shielded from a lot of comments and stuff like that. I'd say what I did, and I didn't really, I wasn't conscious about this, but what I did when I was building and I was 10 years old to like 10 to 14 is I was just really interested in building. I was focusing on designing, building, competing, and having fun with my friends. And, you know, in middle school, sometimes I'd invite friends over and they'd be like, we'd be like, yeah, here's a screwdriver. Why don't you help me with a robot? And they thought it was hilarious because that's not normal kid life. But I was just really happy to be able to build something. And so that's where my focus was. I would say if you're trying to do that in an age of social media and YouTube and all that, just don't read the comments. Don't get in there at all. It's not worth it. Do what you want to do. If you're having fun, don't let anyone stop you. There's like plenty of people that are like, oh, 10-year-old girl, like what is, she's not going to build anything that's worthwhile. It doesn't matter, right? Like if you're having fun, if you lose all the time, but you're having fun and you're learning, then who cares what those weird people, you know, are saying that you don't know, because they're just random people on the internet. So I would say just take yourself off of all of that and don't look at it. Yeah, I'm sure there's probably more to the question than I'm forgetting. What were the other parts of the question?
No, I mean, that was great. I think that you really covered just about everything in there. And so thank you for sharing that. I really enjoyed your advice. But Mary has a second follow-up question. She says, for a lighter question, you and your fellow judges are having a robot fight, but your robots are Mecha Pete, Mecha Greg, and Mecha Trey. Choose your fighter.
Okay, is Pete, Greg, or Trey?
Yep.
Oh my god.
Mary always comes out with the hard-hitting questions.
This is hard. And I feel like I don't want to piss any of those people off. I know Pete has, you know, like 25 years of weapon button pushing experience. Greg and Trey were on a team together a long time ago and they had robots that were super sweet. And I'm gonna have to leave it there because I don't want any of these people mad at me.
You could always go with a modular bot and just swap them out, depending.
Yeah, how about it's all three of them and they have like a multi-bot?
they snap together like Voltron.
Hell yeah, yeah.
All right, Lisa, I have a question from longtime competitor Orion Beach, who asks, what keeps you personally interested in combat robotics?
Oh, Orion. Hello. Hello, good friend. Well, it depends if it's fighting robots or robotics in general, because like the industry of robotics is huge. It's growing. It's pretty awesome right now. And especially with this pandemic, it seems like, well, robots could be the answer to a lot of things, with, you know, them moving things around and stuff instead of humans. But in terms of combat fighting, I think, you know, it's just the evolution of it as well. Just like almost the robotics industry in general. But you can see it a lot faster, I think, and a lot more entertaining in robot combat, because you know, you have years where it's like, oh, okay, this tombstone type weapon is very useful. And then people are evolving and defending against that. And then, you know, it's like at one point the Minotaur, you know, you just different weapons are popular, right? And then people are defending against it. And so I just like to see the evolution and how, and also again with the character and the form of things, like how stuff is, the robots can look serious, but then they can look fun and entertaining. And yeah, it's all of it. And oh, sorry, another huge thing would be like the evolution of how people are building. So for me, it was a lot of hands-on. You know, I started off using a scroll saw when I was tiny, and I really do like making the parts each one by one and unique. So that's really fun. But a lot of people have been changing that up and CNCing everything, you know, having one huge piece of billet that's the entire chassis, and just people are really going up and beyond and making these things incredible.
Yeah, it really has been a wild ride for decades now, and that I would totally agree with you. The evolution aspect of it is, you know, the most fascinating. We have another question from a listener, Dan, who asks, what advice can you give someone who wants to break into robot combat but has minimal engineering experience or background?
Yeah, again, sort of like before, don't listen to people. So I actually have an art degree, but the more you build, the more you just take stuff apart. Take a blender apart, look at a motor, hook it up to some batteries. Like the more you do that, you'll get engineering experience. So I would say, you know, start off if you want kits or if you want to look at YouTube videos and buy parts separately, no matter what you do, if you have some sort of battery and a motor and you just start small and keep doing it and experimenting, you will get so much experience, and a lot of times it's more powerful than if you're just you know, looking at a major or reading something in a book. You know, if you do something, you'll figure a lot of things out, especially if something goes wrong, you will quickly learn not to do that again. So yeah, it's all about having fun and putting parts together.
Yeah, and I agree. There's definitely a part about like embracing what makes you unique, because that eventually will manifest itself in a unique bot. I love tying back to the last question. Like, one of the things that I really also love about the sport is seeing like how someone's like knowledge outside of combat robotics translates into combat robotics. So when you have like a group of engineers that like, you know, they were all like, you know, mechanics and welders, how that translates into building a bot versus like someone who is, you know, a roboticist for NASA, like, and how they would build a robot. It's really interesting when you see those dynamics and how they play out and how these things take shape.
Totally, totally. I love that too. And it's really, you know, it's whatever tools you're used to having or using, you know, whatever you find in your basement. Well, I guess in California, it'd be like what tools you have, not in your basement, because no one has basements. But you build the, you know, depending on what you have around, right? So and with robots, there's sort of sometimes maybe there's like three schools of thought now, but there's for the most part been two schools of thought, which is like the welding people and then the bolting people. You know, and I think it does, like you said, sort of sometimes stem from your job. Like, do you do stuff for NASA or are you like a car mechanic? And then you take those skills that you know and push that forward and use that.
Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us for the last hour. This has been just the best. So thanks so much for that. We're really looking forward to seeing you at BattleBots again soon.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait. And thanks for all these great questions. It's really making me excited to do the next season.
Amazing. We'll talk to you again soon.
After the break, we'll return with this week's installment of Robots Around the World.
Welcome back from the break. Time for Robots Around the World. This is a new segment we're starting this week in place of the events calendar, where we'll tell you all about a delightful robot from outside the world of combat robotics. This week's robot is the Cave Rover, a project out of Indiana to build robots capable of exploring the world's cave systems by remote control. The robots run on treads and are capable of getting through extremely narrow spaces underground. Earlier this month, the team behind the Cave Rover project traveled to Florida to test a swimming robot that's designed to explore underwater caves, which is so darn cool. The project began in September 2018 and has grown to include 5 dry cave rovers, two underwater robots, and 3 drones. If you're interested in checking out the project yourself, go to www.caverover.com and follow the team's progress on YouTube. Here's a fun fact. Cave Rover's founder, Chris, aka Lotus Petal, is joining Ed Robinson's BattleBots team during the 2020 season, so you'll get to see him on BattleBots, and he'll be there helping out Ed with Sharko. So this is really, really cool, because I wish I was a professional cave spelunker, but now I can at least follow along this robot and see how it's doing.
I like to look inside of caves, but I like to stay away from caves whenever humanly possible. So sending robots in to get stuck and then hyperventilate and pass out, that let them do that.
Yeah. One of the coolest things about the Cave Rover project is that the robots are connected to the internet. So while they're inside of the cave, if they want to, they can turn over control of the robot to just a random stranger on the internet, and they can drive the robot remotely. I was talking to Chris earlier today, and he was saying sometimes when he's just, you know, wants to have fun, he'll turn on one of the robots inside of his own shop and just open it up to the internet and allow anyone to just drive it around the shop, which is like pretty cool. Really talented roboticist. This is a really cool project. It's going to allow scientists to take a look at cave systems that were inaccessible before. And I think this is a really, really cool application of robotic technology.
It's probably also highly effective to help find maybe lost spelunkers or people who have become trapped in a cave system. Like if you've been down there for a couple of weeks, this thing could probably run you a hand sandwich pretty quick.
Yeah, that's true.
One of the things that I think would be a really awesome application for this technology, I think back to all the cave paintings and archaeological dig sites that we found that we don't necessarily want to disturb or, kind of get human interference in there. So sending in these robots to explore those and check out those artifacts would be really cool. I know some of the cave paintings in France and whatnot, they really try to keep the amount of human observers down. So it would be amazing to be able to send a cave drone in there to look at what's going on and take photographs and really analyze the work.
Mm. Yeah, and finally we'll be able to tell if the creatures from The Descent are real or not.
I don't want to know that.
Well, what could happen is a few of these cave bots could get trapped down in the underbelly of a cave system and then actually begin to form a new cave-dwelling robot race.
Whoa.
That will kill us all.
Oh, well, nope. There goes my support for this project.
Lotus, don't take that advice, please.
Well, that's about it for us today. We'll be back in your feed next Wednesday with another mystery guest. We'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye, folks.
Stay safe and healthy.
Bye, everybody.